item 1974. It's a collapsible whip. It goes from 24 inches out to about 8 feet. You now, and it has 3/8 studs, and you now can go to a bracket that will allow you to make it into a dipole. And I just found out, doing a lot of research, for anyone to know this, MSJ is the only product in which both elements are not connected to the chassis of the mount. That means even the ground is insulated from the chassis. And that's it. A lot of the other mounts, what they do is they put in two stuffs, one for your hot leg, for the hot side of the dipole, which is one element, and the other element is just connected to the chassis, and that means that if you're trying to make a halfway dipole, the other dipole, the negative side of the dipole, is also going to be, you know, your shield is going to have to go to the pipe and everything, and I know that doesn't work well. I think you would agree with me on that also, that if you're going to make a dipole, you want both sides of the dipole to be off of ground. That means you want to go to a balance, but at the same time, you don't want to have the shield going to the other quarter wave element and also being tied to the mount, because then you don't have a quarter wave at that point. You know, you don't have a fully balanced antenna. So what I was asking, Dick, is has anyone here, and if you can...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Hey, you turned out the last 30 seconds on the machine, Howie, but I heard you on the input, not to worry. I agree with you. The nicest way to see the dipole is in the center, and the left side and the right side should both be isolated from ground. And if you like it to be a pure antenna, you're going to feed it with a balun. By that I mean, it's very easy to take a piece of coaxial cable, connect the center conductor to one half of the dipole, and connect the shield to the other half. The way a dipole works is such that Mother Nature forces that antenna to be almost a balanced structure. The signal flowing down your coaxial cable, in theory, all of the signal is between the center conductor and the inner surface of that outer tubular structure, the outer shield. That's where all the signal is supposed to be, on the inside. And now when you end the cable right at the dipole and connect the center conductor to one half and shield to the other half, the dipole tries to balance itself. At one instant of time, when the right-hand side of the dipole is plus 1 volt, at that exact same time, the left-hand side tries to be minus 1 volt. Well, therefore, you're putting minus 1 volt back onto the outer shield of the coax cable. So without a balance, just by connecting the coax directly to the dipole, you're going to end up with some hot coax. It's not a showstopper. It's also going to radiate. But there are times when that's going to give you some disadvantage, and it's going to give you a different pattern than you planned for. So putting the right kind of a balancing device, which sort of is a isolation transformer, so to speak, right at the end of the cable, at the beginning of the dipole, that forces you to be feeding the dipole in a thoroughly balanced manner. Let me drop. But once you accept the fact you're going to put a balancing device there, and once you use the right kind of a balancing device, and some of them are called a current-fed balun as opposed to a voltage-fed balun, and as long as you've got the right kind of impedance matching, you'll soon realize there's nothing magic about feeding the center of the dipole. We all do that for traditional reasons. If for mechanical reasons or whatever reasons you want to feed the dipole 20% off-center, 40% off-center, 60% off-center, or feed the outer end of the dipole, and simply have a short circuit in the center. In other words, you start it up with a half-wavelength piece of wire and feed the outer end of this half-wave antenna. I'll admit that feeding it that way, you're going to be feeding a 1,500-ohm impedance at resonance as opposed to a 70-ohm impedance. But if you're smart enough to build the right kind of impedance matching network, that can work like a charm. And a pure vertical piece of wire, half-wavelength long, strung alongside of your tower or up the tree or whatever, fed at the bottom, on the outer end of the dipole, can work like a charm, a very high-performance antenna. There's nothing magic about how you get the energy onto the antenna. As long as the antenna itself electronically resonates because of its physical length, or electronically resonates because you've used the right kind of an antenna tuner, as long as it, you're launching the energy onto the antenna and the radiating system is resonant, it'll work like a charm no matter how you feed it. There's nothing magic about forcing it to always be fed in the center. It is easier, it's traditional, but for a whole bunch of mechanical reasons, you may decide to do it some other way. Imagine you've heard me say this a few times, Howie. WB2HWW, K2RIW.
Holy Dick, you're preaching to the choir. Well, what I'm going to do with any of these antennas, and I've been experimenting, I've always done it, is I make a poor man's balance. I just take the coax and make five or six turns and use tape or tie wrap. You can do it that way. You can use a commercial balance. But the question, and also, if you want to make a dipole 50 ohms, you can. All you got to do is just bend it off of horizontal, make it towards a V shape, towards an inverted V, and then as you come closer to 90 degrees, you'll get closer to a 50 ohms. The question that I was asking is, did anyone have experience with the ham sticks as a 10-meter dipole? Are you looking at the MFJ website? They make this. I might use this other thing because I don't have to have it. I don't have to prefab it. They make these collapsible whips that are 3/8 inch that are 3/8 inch threads, and you can also buy elbows if you want to make the antennas swivel. The item number is 1974, and MFJ I think charges like $35 for these whips. They come in 8-foot, 12-foot, and 16-foot. So for 10 meters, you only need 8-foot whips. And they are adjustable to whatever length. And once you adjust them, they stay that way. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, I'm bringing up the MFJ website right now. And looking at 1974, and I see this thing. SS TEL antenna whip, 8-foot, 3/8-24, and so on. So it's a collapsible whip, if I understand correctly. 1974, or is it 1874? Let's see, I'm gonna get the right number. Yeah, you did say 1974. MFJ 1974, $34.95. And you want to know if you use a pair of those back to back, will it work? And I think the answer is it has to. And I presume your motive for choosing back to back collapsible whips is so that it's a portable antenna. Is that it, Howie?
No, I know they're going to work, Dick. No, the reason for using those is they're easy to adjust to get to exact resonance. These are going to be permanent antennas. Once I adjust them, I'm probably going to use kind of epoxy or some kind of Loctite and pull them at each joint so they can't move. The question is this. Here's the question why I asked about the hamsticks. See, the hamsticks are a single piece. They're not adjusted, you know, once they're adjusted, they're not multi-elements. So you got to worry about problems with the joints. Because remember, it's a telescopic antenna, and, you know, if it's going to be out in the weather, it's going to get corroded. It might get, I won't say corroded, but you may have problems 6 months, a year down the line. What I'm trying to, the question that I was saying is this. If you go to a 10-meter hamstick, what would be the difference in receive or transmit efficiency compared to using a traditional? I know this whip is basically no different than a wire cut to the exact length. That's all that I was saying is trying to see, without doing my own experimentation, finding out what other people have found out, what their luck has been using hamsticks as dipoles, especially on 10 meters.
W2CH.
Whiskey 2, Charlie Hotel, recognized. Dial free name and go ahead with your comment on this subject, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, W2CH, Ray. Good evening, Dick and Howie. Well, I've used them that way with that adapter for the different bands. 10, 15, 20, portable, I've used them. They do work. Right now I'm in the condominium, and I just used for the contest on 10 and 15 the ham sticks with a ground plane from Lakeview that looks like a tripod. just angling out from my balcony, and I worked as far as Chesterfield Island on 15, and I did work on both bands to Japan and Asia, Russia.
Very good testimonial, Ray. And now, so, obviously they work. But Howie, I know you're enough of a scientist, you want to be more quantitative. The fact that it works, and works well, is not enough. You probably want to know, is it giving you 78% efficiency or 94% efficiency? And there's an easy way you can find out. The brute force approach would be to take the antenna and put it on a real good antenna range and measure it. Well, very few of us have got those kind of resources. The next step of efficiency, and that's what you're asking, how efficient is it? As far as pattern is concerned, once you know the length of the antenna, any of the well-made computer modeling programs will tell you exactly what pattern you're going to get. And you can even model it as far as how many wavelengths above the ground, how conductive is the ground, how far up is the elevation angle of radiation, and so on. How much is going to hit the ionosphere at a 20-degree angle. All of that can be modeled. But once again, you're really asking efficiency. And now, all you've got to do, Howie, in my opinion, is play that backwards in your mind. If it is inefficient, how can it be inefficient? There's about three ways that an antenna can be inefficient. Number one, it presents a high standing wave ratio, reflecting a lot of the power back to the transmitter. Your standing wave ratio meter, your bird watt meter, is going to tell you that one right away. The only other kind of inefficiency is within the antenna itself, resistive loss. Resistive loss always presents itself as wasting the energy by turning it into heat. Therefore, if you take the antenna, put 100 watts into it for 3 minutes, turn off the transmitter real fast, and run over there and touch every part of the antenna. If any part of that is wasting any of your energy by turning it into heat, you're going to know right away. Your hand is going to say, hey, that feels hot. A 100-watt transmitter where 1 watt of the power is being wasted, 99% efficient. The average ham, his right hand and his left hand can easily detect the thermal increase in temperature of something that's radiating 1 watt of energy for a couple of minutes. And 1 watt of loss out of 100 represents something like 0.03 decibels of loss, if you know what I mean. That test is extremely sensitive. So you take any of your helical wound antennas made out of a 30-gauge wire if you want to, and you want to find out how much inefficiency does it have. The sophisticated approach would be to look at it with a thermal imaging camera while it's running 100 watts. But the less sophisticated technique is put in the 100 watts for 10 minutes, turn it off, and go over there and touch it. Over to you, Howie, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Turn on I understand that. I'm very well aware of the efficiency. It's not really the efficiency, it's the pattern. You know, you got a helical coil, part of it's helical, that's all. You're looking at that MFJ whip antenna. How well does that look? How well, obviously I can't see it for obvious reasons. How well does it look to you? I've only been able to do a lot of research by reading all about this. As you look at it, how well does that thing look to you, Bill? I'm just worried about the mechanical structure. Is, you know, what worries me is this. It's a collapsible whip. Now, you're going from metal to metal. Now, you got to worry about contact resistance. You got to worry about how tight it is. That's my concern. And my concern was saying, okay, I might as well just go with something that has less mechanical joints and not worry that much about the efficiency. I think the efficiency is not the problem with the hamstick. I think you might see a difference in the pattern, maybe. So that's it, Dick. I don't have any more questions. If anybody else wanted to break in and make a comment on that, you know what? I have to just try it. I have to try playing with the hamsticks in that application. And if you want to look at another item, it's number 347, which is the mount. And it shows you the mount. They have a mount that you can make into a dipole. An MFJ is the only mount that allows you to make a balanced dipole. Most of the other mounts that you'll see by a lot of other manufacturers, one of the elements is tied to the chassis or to the piping, and that doesn't work. So, back to you, Dick, if you want to make a comment on what that collapsible whip looks like, how well built it is, in your opinion. K2RIW, WB2HW.
The collapsible whip made by MSJ 1974, the photograph of it is fairly low in resolution. It looks like a very skinny vertical object. It says it's 8 foot tall, and you're concerned about the fact that the individual junks and joints in between all of the telescoping sections, when the antenna is brand new, they make good contact and sufficient antenna, and you're sort of worried that if it's out in the weather or if it's in a damp environment, that those joints will corrode a little bit, they'll make poor contact, and you worry about the inefficiency that'll create. If you don't really need the collapsible structure for portability, then I'd much rather see you take, instead of using an 8-foot-long whip, a pair of those from MFJ, I'd much rather see you go to Home Depot or Lowe's and buy 8 foot of aluminum tubing or copper tubing. In other words, buy a solid chunk of metal that's 8 foot long. And now you don't have any joints. You don't have to worry about them. And the mechanics can be it's fairly similar. When it comes to the pattern of the helical wound antenna, believe it or not, there's almost no magic there, Howie. As I used my previous example of a full 80-meter half-wave dipole, 132 feet long, and step by step I start cutting it down to shorter and shorter lengths, and I eventually get it down to 30 feet, let's say, and I've got a real nearby wide dynamic range antenna tuner, and I'm re-resonating that 32-foot dipole, but I'm still using it in the middle of the 80-meter band. The efficiency will be still 99%, if you know what I mean, if I've done it correctly. The voltage on the tips of that dipole are going to get much, much higher, and I put a whole lot of power in it, and eventually going to create an arc in the air. But those are minor details for the extremes of use of the thing. The pattern will become a little bit more broad. In other words, the normal figure eight pattern gets a little bit fatter when you make the dipole shorter, and that gives you what you think is half a dB of loss of gain. That's only half a dB of loss in broadside gain, peak of the beam gain, if you know what I mean. You're just putting a little bit more energy somewhere in space. You're just redistributing the energy. It's not inefficiency when the gain goes down a little bit because you've made it shorter. So you soon realize that the pattern that you get is strictly a function of how much real estate in wavelengths you've used at that frequency and whether the wavelengths you've used are helical wound, zigzag, or whatever. Very minor differences, very slow. Because, there's a zillion different ways I can use 20% of the real estate compared to the full dipole. And a naive person will think that because I've helical wound the bottom of it, I'm launching this brand new magnetic field, I'm launching this brand new axial mode helix signal. Well, each of those turns on your helix are very, very short compared to a wavelength. That radio signal doesn't see them as a new radiator. That helical wind section will still radiate in the transverse mode, in the broadside mode. And you get a tiny bit of difference in pattern if you put the helical coil at the base of the dipole as opposed to at the tips. You get a little bit of difference, but it happens very slowly, and you can model that. So we're talking about a half a decibel of total gain difference. When I take a full half-wave dipole down to something like 20% of its normal length, and so a half a dB is not what you're really worrying about. The pattern can't change very much because the method of radiating, and just because you've changed the real estate. Only when you start getting multiple wavelengths of real estate being used do you start developing real antenna directivity pattern. A 5/8 wave antenna, for instance, starts developing some brand new lobes and brand new lobe amplitude. So when you get 5/8 wave of a ground plane, which is the equivalent of 10/8 waves, which really means 1 1/4 wavelengths of total electrical length when you include the mirror image in the counterpoise, now you're starting to use enough real estate, you're starting to develop more complicated patterns. Just to take it to the ridiculous extreme of a waveguide frequency range, a horn antenna, or a parabolic dish antenna, now you've got some real directivity. You can start coming up with numbers of like 7 and 6 and 5 degrees of beam width and 30 and 35 decibels of gain. Well, where does that gain come from? It came from the fact that you've now used 10 wavelengths of diameter of emitting surface, whether it be the mouth of the horn or whether it be the reflector of your parabolic dish antenna. You start using 10 wavelengths, and you divide the 10 into that magic number 70, and it predicts you're going to have something like 7 degrees of beamwidth of the resultant signal. So pattern comes from real estate. And when you start making the real estate go towards zero, the pattern shifts very slowly from the normal dipole pattern. Okay. Paul, if he's available, WS2N, he's going to tell us what's going on in space. I wonder if you're there tonight, Paul. WS2N. The man in Ronkonkoma, K2RIW in the tech bed.
Okay, Dick, yeah, it's WS2N. Yeah, we're here, Dick. So, yeah, I thought I heard another station. Okay. Not really that much going on this week. I know they just launched another Progress ship up to the International Space Station. You know, they lost one back in August, and so now they set this thing up with 6,000 pounds of stuff to resupply the ISS. They'll get that ready for three newcomers that will be going up on a Soyuz in November. But that's pretty much it. There's a couple of satellites that are going around the sun. I saw on the NASA site that passed the five years ago they launched a stereo. They called the two satellites the stereo satellites. They were launched around the sun. Let me drop it. To take pictures and information from the sun. They're identical. They were launched at the same time. One in a lower orbit, one in a little higher orbit. This way, the one in the lower orbit is able to drift in front of the Earth as the Earth goes around the sun, and the one in the higher orbit goes slower and drifts behind the Earth. So as time goes on, they get further and further apart, and they reach the five-year point now where they're actually opposing one another. In other words, as far as one satellite is concerned, the other satellite is on the other side of the sun, you know, 180 degrees from the sun. Let me drop it. And the Earth is, you know, would be at a 90. And that's going to continue on another, I think, 3 or 4 years from now. They'll completely join up together again, you know, on the other side, and then another 10 years after that, they'll be back with the, where Earth is. So these things supply information. You know, when things happen on the sun, you don't know what's happening on the other side from our view from Earth. So these satellites are able to look at the side, and you know, they can see all kinds of, you know, solar activity that's going on, and we're able to predict now, you know, more information about these coronal mass ejections and all. So I remember talking about the stereo launch probably about 5-6 years ago, you know, before it went up. Here we are 5 years away. Back to you, Dick. Progress ship and the stereo satellite, WS1.
How many astronauts, cosmonauts are on the International Space Station right now? And because of the previous Progress ship that failed and didn't bring them materials, did that give them any worry about how many people on board were consuming? And did they lower the number of people on board over the last couple of months? Paul, go ahead.
Well, there were some websites that I went to, not NASA, but they thought about, you know, from reading space.com, I think a couple of the other ones, I think they're the ones that had it, possibly abandoning the whole ISS, let it go on autopilot. But the NASA site never really had that. Without what they were worried about is not being able to send crews up again. You know, they used the same rocket, same launch vehicle, proton rockets, to launch the Progress ships and the Soyuz. And if they couldn't figure out what the problem was, then they wouldn't be able to send crews up. But they found out what it was. It was essentially a small error. But it did cause the Progress ship back in August to come back and land in Russia. Let me drop it. And as far as the crews on board is six, it's been like that for quite a while, and it's going to remain that way. The last Progress ship just left. That gets burnt up over the Pacific. They do that every time. For instance, this Progress ship is going to go up there. It'll dock on Wednesday and stay there for another, I think, well, January or February, and then undock, and they'll burn that one up as well. Actually, this one's a little special. After they undock, they're going to send them to a higher height before they burn it up. But they take all the garbage and crud and stuff that, you know, that accumulates on the space station, and they put it on these old Progress ships before they undock, and they deorbit, burn up. That's how they get rid of their garbage, and there's tons of it. So you have six people on board, and three more going up. Well, you'll have a crew, you know, you'll have three come back, and then you'll have three more go up in November. Let me drop it.
And how soon after November would the other three come back down?
Well, the other three usually come down first, and then the other three go up. That's usually the way it works. So, this, you know, everybody has a spaceship to get back in case you had to abandon the space station. You know, right now, for instance, there's two Soyuz spacecraft attached to the ISS. So the other three will leave. At least one spacecraft attached, and then now you'll have a new one in November. And they stay attached for about 6 months before they come back. But here you got 6,000 pounds of stuff going up. You've got fuel. You know, they do bring fuel up for the space station. And, it's almost like 2,000 pounds worth of stuff every time they bring one up. And then you've got they always bring up water. That's usually about 1,000 pounds. And then, gigantic bags of water. You've ever seen them. They don't come up in like barrels. They're big bags. And then you've got, maybe 100 pounds or so of oxygen. And then that leaves the other 3,000 pounds, usually spare parts and stuff, you know, experiments, computers, things that, the ISS needs. Back to you, Dick. WS2.
By the way, 62.4 pounds per cubic foot is water. 1,000 pounds of water is 16 cubic feet of water. Almost exactly 16 cubic feet. One way of looking at those great big bags you're discussing. The next interesting thing that you and I care an awful lot about is Curiosity, which I think is going to be launched in December. That's the next great big Mars rover, which is going to be about the size of a Volkswagen automobile. The Mars Science Laboratory, I think it's called. It's going to really do a very serious look for the evidence of life. And the other thing that you and I care an awful lot about is the James Webb Telescope. You've told us, and I've forgotten, what's the best prediction right now as to when the James Webb Telescope, which is going to be a lot bigger in capability than the Hubble Space Telescope, when is James Webb likely to be launched up, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, you're looking at 2018, Dick, so you've got 7 years from now. I'll put that in the Lagrange Point 2. So that'll be a million miles away from Earth, four times away from the Moon. It's going to be a great telescope. There's one out there now at that Lagrange point too. It's called the Herschel. I give you an idea that's also infrared, and that's got this gigantic mirror on board, but nothing like.
Wow.
Twice the diameter of that. Herschel's pretty big, but that's not going to last forever. You know, that's got helium on board to keep it cool or cryogenic. But a James Webb is going to be a forever telescope. It's going to have this gigantic sunshade type of. It's even got.
James Webb
does cover infrared, does it also cover optical and IR, or is it strictly infrared pole, Grant?
I believe it's primarily IR. It does come close to... I don't know. I'm going to have to check. And actually, there's a little difference between this one and the Herschel. There's near-infrared, and then there's infrared. So I forget which one is which. But, it's a big mirror. I would imagine they'll have optical on there, just like with the Hubble covers a lot of different things. It doesn't only just cover visible. But this thing, of course, it's got spectrographs on there. You know, you'll be able to tell what everything is made out of. That's one of the most important things that this thing has. So, let's see, the other question. Oh, yeah, helium? No, it doesn't have that. It's similar to what they put on the space station. That thing doesn't have it either. It doesn't have the cryogenic telescope thing that they attach to the space station. It's kind of like that. Don't need it, Dick. They've really come a long way with this stuff. They really have to keep it out of the sun. Or, actually, away from the Earth. They don't want the light from the Earth to even hit the sun. So, I guess, anything I've read on the James Webb, they're going to get a minimum of 10 years. You know how that goes. They always extend everything. The Hubble, that went up, 1990. Here we are, 2011. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds good. Looking forward to these. When you go to the NASA website on the subject of the Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory, and you look at their animation of the landing sequence, wow. My goodness. There's a zillion steps of it entering the Martian atmosphere, using the heat shield, dispelling the heat shield, using a small drogue chute, using a larger drogue chute, going on a suspension cable on the drogue chute, blasting rockets to slow it down some more, and so on. There's a very complicated landing sequence to make that thing sit down upright on its wheels on Mars. A lot of stuff's got to go right in that last few minutes after, basically a year of traveling between the Earth and Mars. And it looks like that thing's got a lot of mobility and a lot of fancy scientific instruments for measuring spectrum. It can aim a laser beam at a rock and look at the reflected signal and know what the rock is made out of without even eroding the rock and putting it inside its laboratory. So if that thing can successfully get there, it looks like a very stealthy machine. And I think Steve Squire is, according to one of the NASA reports I saw, one of the NOVA programs, looks like Steve Squire is involved in this one again, as he was with Spirit and Opportunity, very heavily involved. Okay, we've done almost everything of our obligations, and now we go to the wide open stuff.
And 60.
Go right ahead, Wes.
Light subject. Before we go to the heavy one, comparing gravity and magnetism. Now, with your permission, I would like to go to the little of the introduction.
Yeah, go ahead. And to relate gravity and magnetism, I think is going to be a very difficult thing. They have very different characteristics, and are they related at all? Interesting. The fact that they both obey a kind of an inverse square law would lead you to believe that they're related. But other than that, are they really related is a darn interesting question. You got it, Wes.
And to explain. Well, a little interaction before I ask the question. So the gravity and magnetism line in the opposite sides of the mirror mathematically, that's what you said, and that is why the most intense part of the electromagnetism lies of the outside outside the most intense part of the gravity light, how to say it properly. Well, it is obvious that when we're trying to compare the mass of these two systems, it looks different. So if we look closely at a EM field, then we discover that with the magnet, that field intensity falls off outside the magnet, and as the distance, the cube formula of or the volume. So one on the inside of the magnet, as we increase the volume of the magnet, the field only becomes stronger as a function of the area of the poles, which is the distance squared relationship. Let me jump.
Do spitania babuszka.
So, the in fact, magnets are related by the lines of flux per square inch of polar surface, which is a constant for any magnet type. This means that if we start to stockpile of disks, let's say, magnets, and stacking higher and higher and higher, that will not increase the poles of magnetic field strength at all, as it has not become larger on the pole's surface area. Now, we can relate the magnetic field to the cube volumetric relationship outside the mass of the magnet, and then squared relationship inside the mass of the magnet. And then if we look very closely into that, we see that the gravity would look like an... the gravity... We look closer at the gravity and we discover that it is exactly reverse of that... of that mechanism. Let me drop. Outside an object, the pull of gravity drops as the distance squared function. But now, as we increase the diameter of the sphere, the weight of it increases by the cube. So a ball or cube will up to, let's say, 8 times increase in volume and also in the pull of the gravity. So we can relate the gravity field to the cube or volume relationship inside the mass of an object and the square relationship outside the mass of an object. Now, I've got the conclusion. The field density for each of the different forces originating in the opposite places with respect to the boundary of the object are somehow anchored into. So, if we continue to increase the diameter of the spherical magnet, and let's say this magnet is, let's say, the very good quality, less than the gravity, linked directly to the volume of the sphere. So if we then grow the magnet to the size of the Earth, or magnetic poles stuck on the poles anywhere because it is a square inch force, and our disk is 1 inch of the diameter. So the weight of the iron disk, let's say we have a certain weight of the iron disk, this would increase observing the Earth system at surface. And the magnet is the force of separation of the individual, or let's say the individual outer world function, and the gravity is the force of inner unity between all mass present within the system to a single center point vector. Related to the consciousness, the ground, the hollow sphere in the space, and the person was floating inside it, where would be found the center of the gravity? To which point would the person be pulled? I can represent that scenario as a of the gravity as the center of the gravity. There is a center of convergent path of the radiant light, if you wish.
In the outside of the shell, you wouldn't be able to easily tell whether or not it is a shell of a material or a uniform sphere. In either case, from the outside, it will have what's called central force motion. It'll appear as though all the gravity is coming from one point in the center of that shell, even though there's really nothing there. So according to Lewis Epstein, that's the way it would happen if it's uniform. However, life gets a little bit more complicated if the shell is not really uniform. If the shell is made up of a whole lot of little bitty spheres that are arranged to make from a far field view, all the gravity adds to zero when you're on the inside of that surface. Now, in the case of, that's what gravity does. In the case of magnetic field, I want to ask John a question. John, you've owned a whole bunch of these quarter-sized neodymium magnets. They're circular magnets. You shipped a couple of them to me, and they're about the diameter of a quarter. It's my belief that if you stack two of them together with the north-south polarity, and then you put them against a chunk of steel, and you try to remove them from the chunk of steel, you will sense a stronger magnetic field when a pair of them are stacked as opposed to one single magnet. I didn't say it's easy to do, but I believe you definitely get a significant magnetic field increase when you stack a pair of them. I'm not going yet to the great big stack, just a pair of them. Am I correct in what you've seen so far along those lines, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Dick, from my experiments, you are correct, because what I did was I had a single magnet. I used a second magnet on. It increased the amount of tension you had to put on that scale. I don't remember how much. It wasn't twice, but it was maybe like 1.25 or...
In order for the extra magnetic field to come out of the end, the local magnetic field in the ones at the end would have to be stronger than it was before. And those neodymium magnets, I'd like to believe, they were magnetized at the factory to be near the saturation level plane of these things. And now all of them are somehow attached together, like being glued down to a non-magnetic surface, and you bring the forward surface of those magnets to a great big chunk of steel. I'd like to believe in that circumstance you would get an amount of pulling force that is not quite but close to the number of magnets. In other words, two of them side by side, one of them all by itself, or 10 of them side by side. 10 of them side by side, I'd like to believe you're going to get close to 10 times the pulling force requirement to pull them away from a great big chunk of steel. You probably...
part, the scale wouldn't go that high, of course. Only made, I think, 50 pounds, something like that. And I had to actually use a wedge and a hammer to break them off.
Could you have removed the magnets from, the individual magnets from the bar of steel in order to lower the local magnetic field in order to do the separation? Could you have slowly taken the thing apart, John? Go ahead.
Dick, I could not even slide the two pieces of steel. Usually you can slide them off. It wouldn't slide off. I actually had to wedge it and separate it. Excuse me. And then what I did was I tried it single row. And, of course, it was a lot easier to take it off. No empirical measurements, but it was an enormous problem to get it apart. And I was worried about breaking them. Even when I put it together, it snapped in so fast, I thought they were going to shatter all of my...
Now, you were taking this strip of steel and magnetizing it by putting... quarter-sized magnets across, let me call it the back surface, and you did that twice with two chunks of steel and then brought them together. Could you have peeled away one quarter-sized magnet at a time as a method of separating the whole structure? Go ahead.
No, Dick, I didn't explain it properly. The two chunks of steel that are about 3 inches by six, there were two of them, they were sandwiching the magnets in between. So there was no hope of getting anything apart.
Oh, ho. And in order to do things gently, it would have been nice to have the two chunks of steel just barely overlapping at one edge and slide the upper one against the magnets plus the lower one. But I think you're saying the strength of attraction was so strong that you couldn't even slide them. If one of the chunks of steel was vertically polarized on the edge of a steel table, a very strong wooden table, and you hit the other one with a mallet, could you force them to slide a little bit in that mode? John, go ahead.
I imagined if I locked one of the bars down and tapped it with my mallet, it probably would move. Probably have to hit it pretty hard, but I could not move it with my fingers. And the error I made was I should have tried it with a single row instead of making a double row. That was the big error there. And also, my next experiment, when I do it, I'm going to put a light film of machine oil on it and then see if it'll slide. I believe I will be able to get it to slide down, depending on the roughness of the steel.
Your chunks of steel that was... What kind of steel?
836, and it was 3/4 inch steel.
Wow. 3/4 inch thick, 3 inches wide, 8 inches long, and... I think you're saying 18 and 8 steel or something like that. Go ahead.
Alice, 36.
Give me a couple of words on that one. ASTM type steel, A36. Is that considered soft, medium, hard? What is that construction steel? What kind of steel is that, John?
Same type of steel that they make the steel girders, I-beams, and channel iron.
Sounds like good construction steel. So you were getting some really strong forces. So when that upper one got sucked down to the lower one, I think you're saying it got sucked down so violently you were afraid that it could have shattered some of your neodymium magnets. My guess is some of the things you've done over the years have allowed them to slam together where pieces do come off. Is that true?
Yes, Dick, and I believe I sent you a broken one to show you how fragile they were. I've broken about 20 of these things doing these experiments. They're so fragile. Just snapping two of them together, besides the blood blisters on my fingers, they can almost explode. It seems like they explode, but these still fly anywhere they won't stick together. A couple of interesting things I had happen with them themselves. What did I do? Oh, I'll remember it, and I'll check back with you. But basically, you're right what your son mentioned.
Now, ordinarily, a current flow of charged particles, like you've got in the gun assembly of a cathode ray tube, you put a right-angle magnetic field across that neck of that tube, and you will definitely deflect that beam in a very predictable manner.
Oh, that would be my next question.
As it goes down that, CRT neck assembly and eventually hits the phosphor.
Yes, and it will happen if you approach the face, too.
Yep, and I've done that also. You put magnets near the front end of a cathode ray tube type color television set, and you got to be careful how you do that because you can get all kinds of moyer patterns as you disturb everything, and you got to be careful you don't come too close, otherwise you might permanently magnetize things where beyond the point where it's difficult to degauss them to get the set to reconverge correctly. But here's my next question. When it comes to your Wimshurst machine, where you were making sparks between those two probes, and you were holding nearby magnets, and you saw no deflection of the magnetic field of the spark, that's when you were getting conventional sparking. When you open up that sharding barb at the bottom of the base of the unit, between the two Leyden jars, and now you get these very gentle sparks, did you get a chance to try the magnetic field near those gentle sparks to see if there was any kind of deflection that takes place? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, and I have a surprising answer for you. There was no variance either way I did it. But I think my error is the fact that I did not use two magnets on opposing sides of the spark. I don't think a single magnet will deflect the arc.
I think it will, John. In my opinion, you could take a single magnet on the side of the gun assembly of a cathode ray tube, and I have very little doubt in my mind as to whether or not you're going to get a deflection of that beam on the screen. So one magnet on one side with a current flow through a vacuum of the gun assembly of a cathode ray tube will definitely get deflected. Now, you and I, when we use our Wimshurst machine, are looking at a very difficult phenomenon. It is not a free flow of an electron in that spark that you and I see. We are looking at the ionization of air molecules, and we're really looking at a very different kind of trajectory. We're looking at the trajectory of ionized material, and I see some of the mechanisms by which it can behave differently. And so when Glenn's here, we're going to be asking him that question that you and I had that we mentioned last night. But now Wes is going to ask us another question about magnetic fields. N2XJN, K2LIW.
And then I have a question too, Dick, when you get back.
You're on.
No, I'm still on the gravity mechanism. I want to continue with that before I go to the question of the deflection or the yokes. Now, we go to the gravity mechanism. The gravity, the center of the gravity. Let's imagine that you have a hollow sphere, perfect hollow sphere. It does have a center, and then the center of gravity is the center of convergent path of the radiant light. Now, and I asked a question about the person floating inside the sphere and where this person would be positioned and how this mechanism would work like. Let me jump. So, if the gravity is a simple attraction of the mass to mass, as thought, it were a force emanating from all matter, like a magnet or an electric field, then if the person was sitting along the side of the sphere, we would expect they might be pulled to the inside wall and stick there. This is because the gravity is said to become a weaker at the distance from the matter as a function of distance squared. So the weakness of point of the gravity would be the center of the sphere, or most distance point from all sides, which then represent the model of one, somebody would be hard-pressed to stay at the center. However, the recognizing the radiant light model, which I just brought to your attention, will postulate that the center of the gravity is the point of the greatest convergence of the radiant light path, and then is being emanated from all matter with the divergent field. So now we get a different solution. So if we look at all of the sides of the sphere and trace out the wheel of, let's say, 24 of every point around the sphere where the most light concentrates crossing one each other, then there would be a strongest at the center of the sphere, and the person would be in fact pulled into the center of the sphere even through it is hollow. The person would free float at the center, feeling the pull of the gravity inwards the center of their body. They would encounter resistance of the lifting an arm away from the center. Question is for you, am I right in this suggestion, or you think that I'm not?
No.
Yeah, this guy, Lewis Epstein, as I said, has a puzzle just like this one, Wes. And if it is a thin or thick, but it doesn't matter, it is a shell of a spherical material where the shell itself everywhere is uniform. And whenever an object is on the inside of that sphere, whether it's in the center, one third of the way from the center toward the edge, or out touching the inner surface of that outer shell, no matter where you are, you sense zero gravity, because you can add up all the little micro sections of the shell, figure out how much gravity each one of those little micro sections is making to your test mass, that you placed in some place in the center of the shell, and you'll eventually add up to all the forces go to zero. That's what Epstein said. It's a classic puzzle, and unless I've remembered it incorrectly, that is the answer with